Okay, party people.
Is that how you're starting the podcast?
Yeah, I'm starting it by saying, okay, party people. We are today talking about the fourth episode of season 7, which was called Like Bad at Things, which is my favorite episode title ever of anything that's ever existed. Rather than kind of hit on the key thematic points first, we're going to just kind of go chronologically straight through. And the first first scene of the episode is between Keen and Wellington. Keen knocks on Wellington's door at the beginning of the morning and says, "My presidency's just been hijacked." And he basically comes clean right away about the fact that he was the one who went behind her back and ordered that air strike or whatever it was in Syria. And he's like, "You should be grateful. All of the morning talk shows are really excited about this." And she's like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" And that's kind of where the episode kicks off. And I really loved that scene because I loved the way that she said morning talk show crowd.
You okay. Know, I didn't actually love Keen's delivery.
Why? I thought it was so funny. It was really good.
I don't
good.
Know. I guess maybe because the show is so realistic in every other facet of its existence. It did not ring true to me.
Oh, I actually thought quite to the contrary. You don't often see women like yelling like that in such full force. And I felt like she just put her entire body behind yelling that. And I like actually really loved the way that she delivered the line.
I was really... It felt really interesting for me, the whole Wellington talking down to her kind of thing, because it makes me wonder like what it would have been like for Hillary.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week, how like everyone is doubting her, and you know, we obviously see it this week, but it's a little bit different because like on the one hand, he just went behind her back and completely like violated her authority as president in a really serious way. Like, she could have had him thrown in jail. Like, what he did was fully against the law.
It was treason.
Yeah, exactly. But then at the end, he was like, you know, "I came to work on your campaign for a state office. And at the time, I was only running, like, national campaigns. And I did that because I believed in you. And I believed that one day, like, that you would ascend to the highest office
and that we would be here."
Right, exactly. And I just thought like it was kind of interesting, and it was like, I don't know whether or not he was being sincere or he was just playing.
I think
her.
He was desperate. Yeah. I think he was desperate. He almost seemed like he was holding on a little too tight. Like he was like grasping at straws, kind of like trying to convince her that his intentions had her best interests in mind, which I'm right now I'm at like prime, like
maybe
mole,
he does though. Like I'm a little bit less convinced that he like. I don't know.
The
I felt
more
like,
damning
I felt like
evidence
he played it
we
so
get.
Sincerely, I felt like he played it so sincerely as to like, "I truly do love you and I believe in you, and like I'm just trying to get you out of your own way a little bit." Like I kind of believed that. So either that's what's going on or he's just a really good actor.
But that's so far from where he was at the end of 6/12. Like he was the one who said to Carrie, like, "Yeah, we used you." Like he was totally complicit in the 200, and like unless like I'm missing something,
yeah,
I don't know
true.
Where that went too far for him until recently. All of a sudden he was like, "Well, now we've got the 200 released," and like I don't know if, you know, we were supposed to assume, like, in the first episode that maybe he thought she went way too far, and now he's trying to pull her back. I got the sense that maybe he, I don't know, like I said, I'm at prime, like, mole hunting season right now, so I want to know, like, what his role is. Like, is he, what is he up to? Like, is he being sincere? I get the impression maybe he's not. I think he just seemed a little too desperate. I thought, you know, he almost begrudgingly made that call to the general, I thought. Like, he seemed kind of stressed about it in that moment and played it that way. I don't know if that's because he was circumventing her or if because he had to circumvent her because that was the order that he was given.
I'm definitely having a hard time getting a read on the character overall.
The earlier in the season, we're getting all of this information about how his girlfriend was 3 miles away from Hazleton and was collecting money at all of these cash dash places. The more evidence that stacks up against him, the less I'm convinced that it's real, because the show does not play straight ever. So I wonder, like, part of me genuinely wonders if he really had nothing to do with McClendon's death and believes that she did.
Interesting.
I don't know. I guess I feel like I could argue against myself. You know, I definitely feel like I could make a case for one and I could make a case for the complete opposite, because right now the show is kind of like, I don't really feel like there's a lot of evidence for or against. Like, I'm trying, like, imagine for a second that you're back in, you know, the year 2011, 2012, and you're watching the first season of the show when they were being really cagey about who Brody was, and, like, they would present you with some evidence for, and then they would, like, present you with some sort of evidence against that, and you, like, it was very, like, you didn't know what to believe. One second you felt like he was turned, and the next second you felt like he was completely innocent and he was just, like, in, you know, a great amount of trauma or whatever. And actually both things ended up being true. So I kind of feel like it could be like that. Like, he could have ulterior motives, but he could also, you know, have what he believes are her best interests at heart. Like, I don't think that it's so black and white as, like, yep, he's a mole and he's working for the Russians and, like, this is what's happening and, like, all of his intentions are completely nefarious. Like, I feel like it's probably going to end up somewhere in the middle. Otherwise, I don't know. Like, it's just, I feel like they're playing it kind of in such a gray area that it's, it's really hard to tell, like, where he's going. And I feel like maybe that's the point of it.
Well, I think Homeland has, to whatever degree of success, attempted to repeat that whole Brody coup that they did every season. We had a similar thing when Quinn first arrived. We didn't know what to think about him, and especially, like, you had Carrie and Saul and Max and Virgil going behind his back. And in season 4, we didn't really know what to do about Khan. In season 5, Allison was presented as trustworthy until she wasn't. Like, there's always something. They're always trying to do this. And I feel like in this season, for the first time since the whole Quinn thing in season 2, I think they're finally achieving it.
Yeah, this definitely, like, I totally agree with you. Like, I would even argue that Quinn was, like, a kind of smaller scale thing of that. Like, and this isn't even to the extent of Brody, where it was, like, the entire question of at least the first, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of season 1 was, like, is Brody turned? Like, that became the central question. And then they kind of decided, okay, it's not actually as interesting to figure out, like, and to have that be, like, the entire theme of season 1 about whether or not he was turned. Like, let's show whether or not he was. And then be, like, is he going to do something? You know, like, that seems, I mean, and I think it applies to this, too. To me, it's much more, it's not as interesting to ask the question to me, is Wellington a mole? It's more interesting to ask the question, is he going to be turned? So I kind of feel like in all the cases that you know, were talking about, like, Allison's a really good example. We had reason to be suspect of her, and then maybe what, around episode 5 or 6, it was, like, revealed that she was a mole and she was working with the Russians, and then it just became a question of, like, okay, now what's she gonna do about that? And that became a lot more interesting itself than this kind of yes or no question of, like, is she or isn't she? And so I feel like maybe that's where they're going with this. It is so laughable, though, that the president's chief of staff could be a Russian mole. Like, that's absurd.
Well, you know what I thought was really interesting changing the subject just a hair, were we talked in director's chair last week about how Keen is so in your face, especially with Wellington up until this point. Like, she's always very challenging. Her hands are on her hips. Like, she's always in a very
aggressive,
you know, strong, aggressive. Very aggressive, strong stance. And then on the rewatch back of this episode, I noticed that her and Wellington are actually at that medium distance. They're, even when she finds out that he is the one who did this, she actually, her hands are clasped at her waist. She's not like staring him down like in a defensive stance or aggressively. She's actually kind of takes on this passive look. And I just found that whole, you know, situation in his house interesting. And they kept, you know, going, toggling between like us being there in the house with them. And then also Carrie's view, her bird's eye view, you know, of the surveillance video. And I just thought the whole thing was just very well orchestrated. And I was trying to pick up what the bigger point of that was. I don't know. Wellington, then you see Carrie kind of seeing his reaction when she comes back upstairs after letting Max in. And he's sitting in there with his hands, you know, holding his head a little bit. And it's like, is he, you know, fearful for his job? Like, I think you guys both make a lot of good points. Like, I don't necessarily care if he's the mole or not, but I definitely think there's more going on with him that meets the eye.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. And have we actually seen Carrie doing this kind of in-depth surveillance on anyone since Brody?
Like a little bit with the in season 4 with what's his name?
A little bit with the drones. A little bit.
Farhad Ghazi.
Yeah, she did a little bit of it, but it like it wasn't this.
Like, this is like really
wasn't
intense.
Anyone's like real home like that.
It
I
wasn't
thought,
obsessive.
Like, this is now getting into like way nostalgic season 1 territory for me, but like, and this. These aren't my original thoughts. There was this really great recapper, Jacob Clefton, who did the Television Without Pity recaps for seasons 2 and 3. And he talked about the show so beautifully to me. But one thing that really stuck with me about the way, you know, he described the Carrie Brody relationship is like, she fell in love with him, like, through watching him on the cameras. And I'm not implying that Carrie is falling in love with Wellington. His point though is that being in someone's home like that and watching it is a really intimate thing, and for Carrie it allowed this connection to form when she didn't even know him, but she felt like she did. And the show has from the very beginning, it's always really played with this concept of surveillance, and you like never really know who's watching you. And, you know, the Brody surveillance was a big part of that, you know, from the very beginning. And I kind of like the fact that they've brought it back, because to me, it's not like a trope that I feel like they've exhausted so much. I think it's really interesting. And I think it's interesting that Carrie feels so comfortable doing it. Like, she has no qualms about watching him in kind of these really private moments. I think that's interesting, you know, what it says about her character.
Meanwhile, why is Max okay with it? Like, this is the second time
that
he has...
Yeah, you were asking that before. You were like, why is Max doing this for Carrie? And I was like, Carrie is Max's best friend.
Carrie is Max's only friend, and that is the saddest thing I have ever heard in my entire life.
I'm saying this totally seriously, but, well, maybe I'm not. I love Carrie so deeply that if she was my best friend, I don't know. I want her to be my best friend. I know she's like
yes, I know
mess,
how you feel
like...
about Carrie, and I love Carrie Matheson to a slightly lesser extent, but I think we can agree that I love Carrie a lot more than most people do.
Right.
But at the same time, if Carrie Matheson were my only friend, I
not
think I would
only
kill
friend,
myself.
I said best friend.
Okay, so I'm saying only friend because he like apparently
Good
just
Lord.
Follows her around.
I mean,
I don't think that's fair.
I think it's fair because in the series he's gone with her to Islamabad. Then he shows up again in season 6, like in Brooklyn all
Max,
of a sudden.
To me,
and
has
then
always
he
struck me as someone who's extremely talented and is super, super fucking smart. but can't hold regular jobs. And Carrie must be paying him in some way. And I think
not right now, because she is
in debt. How do you know that? I mean, she could still be...
I think he's very loyal. I think he's actually very loyal. I think he's
extremely loyal, but I also think that Carrie and Matt, like, this was something that it's never been explicitly addressed on the show, but in the Homeland Revealed book, they talk about how it was always kind of assumed or discussed as a backstory that Max was on the spectrum in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think that Carrie and Max are outsiders. You know, they don't really fit into society's mold of, you know, what they're supposed to be or what they should be. And I think it's kind of ironic that they kind of found each other and stuck by each other. I think, you know, Max is really loyal to Carrie, but she's also really loyal to Max. Like, last year when he said that he wanted to go into the place that was like the sock puppet thing, she was like, you cannot go there, it's extremely dangerous, don't go. Like, that's a thing that happened last
because
year.
How many people had she put into like it serious matter, harm's though. Way she's and she was still, looking she spent she every single said, day with Quinn.
It doesn't matter. She still said, she was like, you can't do that. It's like way too dangerous. Like, that's a thing that happened. I think that the experience in season 4 brought them like closer together to, you know,
I don't buy that it was about Max in season 6. I think it was about her own guilt because she was confronted with it every single day. But although it is, and I don't want to know if I want to give Homeland credit for this, but very early on in the series, Max is like, I always believed you.
I know. I think that there's mutual loyalty there.
Well, and Carrie's circle of trust is very small. And exactly. Max has been in it since season 1.
He's never betrayed her. He's extremely trustworthy. He's really fucking smart. He's someone that she wants on her team. And I'm like, there's a lot of things.
I just don't know
what
he gets out of it.
There's a lot of things.
I think he gets a lot out of it. I think right now, I think he's just as angry as she is about what happened to Quinn. Yeah, I think we really saw that side of him in season 4 when he was angry about Farrah and wanting to help Quinn behind her back. I think he's an extremely loyal guy. And I think that he wants to right some of these wrongs. And I think he's also, in a way, looking out for her. I think that, you know, him questioning her on, like, why aren't you supposed to be grounded? He's kind of like, come on, Carrie, like, you gotta do this stuff too. But he's also not going to be the one to tell her. He didn't tell Quinn either. Like, he'll let them do what they want, but like, he will be, I think, a little voice of reason, like, all right, but you really should stay grounded, but here's the keys to my car if you need them.
I mean, like, I really love an enabler.
Like,
yes, I agree. Enabler.
But I mean, okay, I don't want to just totally go on like the offense for their friendship being like the most incredible thing ever, but at this point I'll kind of take my wins where I can get them. Like, Max is one of the very few constants from season 1 to now, and I actually feel like Max, I feel like they have some sort of recognition between them, and this isn't something that she really shared with Virgil, you know, which is interesting.
I miss Virgil.
Max is Virgil's brother. He was there from the very beginning. They kind of started out a little bit at odds, but I think that Max, I see Max as like a truth teller, and he kind of, for someone
who's
a little bit on,
who found her pills, right?
Well
Virgil challenged her, and Max,
my point, what I was gonna say is I see him as a truth teller, and I also see him as someone who, despite being on the fringes, really understands exactly what's going on, which is kind of it's interesting, because I do think Maurice Sterling plays him a little bit as being on the spectrum in some way. Mm-hmm. He's like extremely socially awkward. I'm not saying that everyone who is that way is on the spectrum, but I think he has qualities that indicate that that's how he's being played. But despite kind of being on the fringes of the story, you know, for the past 7 seasons, he is always kind of someone who kind of understands what's going on. Like, if you guys remember last season, in episode 2, you know, when Quinn has the seizure in the bodega and
convenience store.
What?
I was saying convenience store. I was just trying to help you find your word.
The bodega. You know, and then the paramedic comes and Quinn doesn't like want to take the pills. And then Carrie comes home and Max is supposed to be babysitting. And he tells Carrie, like, he has a thing about you. Like, I don't know what it is, but it's, like, not good for him. And, like, that's something that no one was ever able to articulate, even though that's very true. But he was he was the only one who really came out and said that. I felt like he did the exact same thing in season 4 as well after the attack on the embassy. Like, he was the only one who was just, like, related to Farrah and related to like he was the only one. Max was like the first person who was there when she found out that Frank had died. Like, I feel like there's a lot of things that bind them together, and I think that I think that there's something actually really beautiful about their friendship, but I'm not so far down kind of the cynical rabbit hole with this show that I'm just like Carrie's using him. I think that there's more to it, actually.
I don't know that I feel like she's using him.
But you were like, is he still like there? Like, what is he getting out of this?
For absolutely 100 million percent certain, why the fuck is Max still there?
I think Gail's right, though. Like, he I don't necessarily has loyalty think- to Carrie, and he had loyalty to Quinn, and he doesn't like what's going on as much as anybody else. And Carrie is his friend. I think that he saw what happened to Carrie at the end of season 1 and the beginning of season 2, and he was like, this isn't right. Right?
Because no, Max was, and
was the one who said, I believed you from the very beginning, and she ended up being right. And I think it's totally possible that there's a part of Max that was like, she was right before, she was right about Islamabad, she was right about all of it, and she's right now, and like, I should help her. Because he has
the means to be able
to, yeah, he trusts her.
Even despite the fact that she was quasi somewhat responsible for Farrah's death.
Yeah, but I think that Max doesn't strike me as someone who holds a grudge that way. You know?
Yeah, I don't get Max. I think I would love to have a sit down with Mari Sterling and be like, dude, explain yourself.
I think it's a little bit, I don't know.
I see Max differently. I guess I totally get it.
That Mari Sterling is the opposite of Rupert Friend for me. He's so attractive in real life.
I did that one place where I was like, he is good. He's very attractive. He's extremely good looking.
He's the opposite of Rupert for me. Maybe you shouldn't put that in the podcast.
You said it. It's going in, baby.
Edging.
All right. Gosh, oh, I'm taking that out. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. All right, so we got to Carrie and Max. We did that whole thing. I guess the next major plot line of the episode is Carrie goes to West Virginia to sort of retrace Simone's steps. And she has what ends up being possibly / probably my favorite scene of the entire series, which is the scene with Carl from Dash Cash. And
Sarah and I were so fucking happy when we discovered that there was an episode titled like Bad at Things.
But I thought it was gonna be like, so Carrie is like bad
like
at things,
bad at things,
which is kind of what it was, but it was so much better than that.
It was, but it was so it was in the third person, like,
right. Yes.
Oh god, that scene was so fucking incredible. Go ahead. I know that you love Carl because of his mustache.
What I was going to say is, so they released the episode early yesterday, so I actually watched it. I was, like, lying in my bed watching the episode, and we got to that scene, and when she first said, like, I have a sister who's bipolar, I paused it, and then I sent Ashley a message, and I was like, is she actually talking about herself right now in the third person? And I, like, I don't know. I freaked out. I thought it was hysterical. And then, you know, she was like, do you know what bipolar is? It's a form of crazy and all this. Like, and then when she said, I had her declared incompetent, he goes, like, bad at things? And she the expression she gives after that, I don't know. The entire scene I thought was hysterical. And, like, sometimes this show is actually really, really funny.
The show can be really funny, and it hasn't been funny in years.
I had to pause for like 5 minutes because I was laughing so hard.
But that scene was so good because it really articulated the way a lot of people feel about bipolar disorder and mental illness. And she was just stating it right out for the crowd, like what people think it is.
It was also interesting, too, because I think people, you know, I think Carrie is definitely an extremely selfish person. And I think she's extremely self-absorbed. That scene was maybe the first time in a very long time, you know, since I can remember, that I felt that she was completely 100% self-aware about her situation. I thought that was a really, I don't know. I think the way that they framed that scene and kind of the device that they used was really interesting.
I did too. I know what it is to try to describe your mental illness to somebody else. And to do it the way that she did it, like ascribing it to a third person who mm-hmm. she doesn't know, and saying, and basically giving her fictional sister like the characteristics that she has displayed, mm-hmm. and recognizing in the moment what a fucking burden she has been.
Right.
And there was also the element of foreshadowing, because Carrie, as far as we know, has not yet been declared incompetent.
Yes. Agreed.
But she will be. I think
let me jump in on that, too, is I think she actually has been extremely self-aware this entire season. So I disagree with that one point, Sarah, because I feel like her therapist scenes thus far have been extremely self-reflective, and her awareness seems... I think that's actually where I've seen the most growth in her character. I think I actually might have even said that the last podcast. The most growth I've seen in Carrie's character has come in the last couple of episodes. Mm. Her self-awareness, reflection. She doesn't see the therapist in this episode, but her conversation with Mustache Man at the Dash Cash, whose real name, by the way, is David Neil Levin. I prepared this for this podcast because his mustache is actually kind of his thing. He's been in Billions and Trivia Night. And
I have to jump in. I'm really sorry for
Sarah
interrupting.
Loves mustachioed men.
But that's not what this is about. Okay, so I was like looking on Instagram about 30 minutes ago, and the guy who played Carl... He has an Instagram.
David Neil Levin.
Yes, he has an Instagram, but he posted a pic of the scene from last night, and he was like, I guess I get to work with you once every 4 years. And I was like, what? When did they work together? He did a commercial with Claire Danes for Audi back in 2013, where she...
Oh, I remember that.
And I was like, oh my God, yes, that was him. I like freaked out. And so now I have to make the gift set for everybody. But I was like, like, I knew he looked kind of familiar, but I think it's hysterical that they did like this commercial. It was back in 2013. It was like right before the 2013.
Can I just tell you guys that I'm looking at the IMDb page?
And I was like, this is so perfect.
I'm looking at the IMDb page for him right now, and he doesn't even get credited with a name. Like, despite the fact that he had a name tag.
He doesn't get credited as Carl?
Well, scroll on down because he's listed as...
Cash Express employee.
He's listed as pedophile number 2 on the Onion Sports Dome TV series.
That's
so you know your mustache
when you
is rocking.
A mustache like that. That's what happens when you grow a mustache.
Oh, on Boardwalk Empire, he was Mustache Man number 1.
Hey, that's better than being Mustache Man number 2 or pedophile number 2. Okay,
right?
I thought that scene was really, really funny, though. The way that she was like, Carl. Like, oh my God, that delivery was so amazing. I was
that scene was both just really, it was amazing because of, it was funny, it was intelligent,
yeah,
but it gave us the view, like it was Carrie stating explicitly what the view of people, what people view bipolar to be.
So let's talk about that because we were having a little bit of a late discussion / light debate this morning about kind of how the show is portraying her bipolar disorder so far this season. And, you know, through the first 4 episodes, it's been a pretty consistent flow, I would say, of like, this is a thing that they're addressing, which they haven't done in probably not since season 3, but then of course afterwards it really tapered off. I don't really have any indication that it's going to taper off.
Properly addressed it since season 1.
Yeah, like, but even then that was kind of, it was kind of at like a simmer, and then it reached like a full rolling boil. But this is a little bit like, it's kind of been at full throttle since the very beginning, and so far I don't see really any real indication that they're gonna let up. I'm not saying she's gonna be manic throughout the entire season, but I think they're wanting us to question every single episode, like, is she sane? Like, is she thinking clearly? Like, is this a person who, you know, should have custody of her kid? Is this a person who should be making decisions like this? Like, is she okay? And I think that, you know, I thought a lot about what you said last week, Ashley, in regard to how this is kind of what they're doing with her illness this year is different than what they've done in the past, because she's manic, but it's not because she like wanted to be that way. Like, this is kind of the first time we've seen her wanting to be better and wanting to take control of that and realize kind of the cost of, like, she can't afford to be going crazy right now. And I say going crazy just because it's kind of, I think, how a lot of people view it. And, you know, this morning we were talking about, is this getting tiresome and like tropey for the audience? Like, we're in the 7th season now. About every other season, they do some sort of a major storyline where Carrie goes off her meds and has some sort of a manic episode. They've never done it with this much, I think, consistency since the very beginning. But, you know, we have been talking about how this season feels different. You know, it's the first time she's really felt self-aware. It's the first time she's visited a psychiatrist with any form of, you know, frequency or regularity.
And wanting to be better.
Yeah. And, you know, like, she's manic now, not because she went off her meds on purpose or by accident, but because the meds stopped working, and which is a thing that actually happens to people. It's not super common, but it does happen. And, you know, to us, you know, to people who watch us so really, really closely and are observant of all these things, it does feel a little bit different. To the average viewer, this might feel tiresome. And if you're really cynical, might feel like it's time for Claire to get another Emmy tape or, you know, whatever. And, but just, you know, this morning talking about, like, how do we feel about the way that they're approaching this? And I think it's really tricky.
I was telling you earlier about, again, I'm not bipolar as far as I know.
Yeah, I don't think you are.
I have been diagnosed with double depression at one point. And I always worry when it comes to my friends, and it's come up a little bit more often lately, if when I am going down, when I'm losing control of sort of my mental health, which I don't always notice, but I worry about it, like, is Sarah just going to get really fucking tired of the fact that I'm depressed and I can't tell you why? And I remember years and years and years ago when this first came up, I was talking to my very best friend, who is still my best friend. And we were driving around our hometown, and I said, just out of curiosity, like, how much of this do you think is me, like, looking for attention? And he goes, a good amount. We were, like, 22 or 23 then. And we've both grown up. But that's how I feel it is for Carrie. And whether or not the writing is angling toward getting Claire another Emmy, getting themselves back on the board with regard to awards, it really rings true to me, because medications stop working. People stop taking their medications when they feel like they're okay. When I started working out on a regular basis, I was at like the high of my life and I stopped taking my meds just because I was like, oh my God, I have all of these natural endorphins. And then I immediately crashed for about 2 months and I couldn't get out of bed. So it's not something that you notice or something that you can predict. There is never anything that will tell you. And I think that's probably more true for someone who is bipolar than for someone who is just depressed. Like you just, you can't know.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think that
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. I was, I was just going to say that I think everything you say rings very true to me, but I think you're in the minority of how you see the season. I think the feedback that, you know, we're getting in our community and on, you know, Twitter, which is kind of a cesspool anyway, but, I think like if you read the comments on all these different recaps or the people that are talking about the show, even my boss, for example, who's a casual watcher, she's kind of like this again.
Oh, how lucky.
And so I do think that while we are discussing some of the nuanced aspects of how this is different and you know, I think Quinn's death setting this off and, you know, and her meds not working and all these things are coming to a head, there, it is different, but it also is the same because, you know, she went off her meds in season 3 intentionally to bag Javadi. She went off her meds in season 5 so she could figure out who was trying to kill her. You know, I feel like it is a little tired and I don't think the nuance is something that people are picking up on because I think to some degree it's maybe for whatever reason they don't care or they don't want to. Or,
same old, same you know, old.
Yeah, I think that's something that the show has to live with.
This is what I would say to that. I think that the show, for whatever reason, decided that their main character was going to have this mental illness. And they wrote Carrie as if she was bipolar without actually realizing that she was bipolar. That's actually what happened. Like, they wrote her with all the traits of someone who is manic depressive without actually like putting a label to it, so to speak. So this has been in Carrie's DNA, you know, from a character standpoint from the very beginning. It's not something where they were like, but we need to give her like a real problem. Like, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like she was like the CIA version of Monk. And if you've never seen Monk, the premise is that Tony Shalhoub plays this obsessive compulsive detective, but it's like a comedy. So he's
I love Tony Shalhoub.
I mean, it's actually a really, really good series if you're like
Because of Wings
into like a mystery kind of a show. It's actually really, really good. But his obsessive compulsive disorder is either played for laughs or it's played as the way that he like figures out like what's going on. Like, he can touch, you know, the doorknob, which makes him see this other thing. Like, it's always played as like, I mean, they say it all the time in the show that it's a gift and it's a curse. And so on that show, I'm sorry to say, as much as I like actually really like it, I think it's like really good. They play his mental illness for laughs and they also use it as a gimmick because it's the way that he, you know, has his superpowers, so to speak. This show is different because I feel like
they subvert it.
They do subvert it. Season 5 is the best example. She goes off her meds because she feels like she's going to gain superpowers and then it blows up in her face. So I feel like the show is actually...
We need to finish that puzzle.
I feel like the show is actually always very honest and upfront about the fact that like it does give her some really great abilities in the moment, but it's also really difficult. It's really, really tough. It's hard. And you know what? It's something where it is tiresome. It is repetitive. Like, it fucking sucks to have to like be on your medications for a number of years and feel like they're working and then to have everyone be like, you like these are no longer working, and be like, actually you have to start over now from the very beginning.
That
like,
is my fucking life.
Like, that's so fucking tiresome.
That's
and
my life.
Repetitive. And to some extent I really admire them for committing to that even 7 years into the thing, where they could just be like, she's reached a plateau and you know she's kind of figured it out. Like, they're really like, they're not doing that. They're making it hard for her. And, you know, as much as I really love the character and I want things to be really, you know, smooth sailing for her, I want it to be really easy. I do feel like, you know, they're kind of are committing to telling a story about this woman who suffers from this mental illness where things are really difficult. And I don't think that we wouldn't be trying to like ascribe Carrie's experience to the entire bipolar community, which is absurd. It's like mental illness and especially bipolar disorder is so unique and it's so complex. It's so nuanced. You can't place one person's experience and say that this is representative of the entire community, but I don't feel like we would be trying to do that or that we would be expecting that they would do that if there were actually more portrayals of this elsewhere in film or TV or whatever. Just by nature of the fact that Carrie's kind of the only one or she's kind of the biggest one, I think we have much larger expectations. It's like the same kind of thing where when there's no representation within the media for one thing, we find the one example of it that's trying to do something kind of in its own little sphere. And if that doesn't, you know, perfectly represent the entire community, then we're like, well, it's doing these things wrong and these and this and this and this. By all accounts that I've read, they're doing actually a pretty good job. I mean, I'm not bipolar, so I can't speak firsthand, but I think that what they're doing this year and kind of what they've done in the past, like, but I would say this year especially, is like, it seems like they're really committing to something, and it might be tiresome and it might be repetitive, but I think that's the actual point. Like, that's the point of it.
I mean, well, and to be fair, she's been a character for 7 years now, like you pointed out. And the show, the original premise of the show is that she's a CIA intelligence officer hiding a bipolar disorder. Yeah. And how does that affect her life? So for all of the people who are like constantly annoyed that her bipolar is,
I think,
you know,
those are the people
the
who
show.
Want it to be a thing where it's like a gimmick. Like, I think that they
well,
might be
I
looking
think
for like an
people...
Adrian Monk sort of a thing where it sort of rears its head, you know, just when she needs it, but it's never debilitating enough that it like really severely affects her life in this like, you know, sort of abject way, you know. And
I
but
mean,
that's not what they're
honestly,
doing. They're like, this
truly...
is like, this is a disorder and like this is affecting her for the rest of her life. Like, there's no cure. There's no way that she can really know whether or not she's okay. Like, there's no way to measure it. Like, that's exactly what you were saying, Ashley. Like, you can't.
This morning, yeah.
Right? It's like an invisible thing is what you were saying. And you can't measure it. There's no cure. It's something. It exists within your mind. You know, it's like it's really tricky. I don't know. I understand the criticisms, but at the same time, I think I really disagree with them.
I mean, so 20% of people are diagnosed with mental illness. Many, 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 many more are actually mentally ill and just don't know it or haven't gotten the proper treatment for it because America is the worst. And it really does get monotonous. And with Carrie's story, honestly, like, for better or worse, we never see representation of mental illness properly. And you made me watch You're the Worst, and that fucked me up because Gretchen's...
That was accurate, right?
It was incredibly accurate, yeah. Where I will just sit down in my bedroom in the dark and not answer anybody, not speak to anybody. And while I can't speak to the experience of being bipolar, I appreciate the fact that it's not being played necessarily for drama. It just is something that is fucking her up. And I would love to have a discussion with somebody who possibly does have more experience with this. But all I can tell you is that I personally have lived through my meds not working anymore and having to decide what to do next.
Right.
And it's hard. Like, it's really, really hard.
So, you know, with that in mind, what do we make this week of Carrie clearly not taking the Seroquel? There was that great scene with Maggie kind of smack dab in the middle of the episode where they kind of have this standoff.
I love Maggie, you know, so much. She's everybody's mom.
I love that scene. It was probably my favorite scene of the episode because just watching the two of them
swallow it.
It is, it's incredible. They're so good together. And, you know, that expression that Carrie gave when Maggie told her to swallow the pills. And by the way, they ring a lot of drama on the show out of like whether or not Carrie will swallow her pills. Like, I half expected her to do like the mock thing where
I did too.
She opened her mouth like she did in season 5. But the expression that she gave when Maggie said to swallow the pill,
but she kind of looks at her like, Maggie,
are you really
like,
are you really fucking serious right now? Like, you really gonna stand here like I'm some sort of child and make me do this? And she narrows her eyes at her and then she turns away and has this kind of it was almost like an expression of betrayal. Like, I think she felt a little bit betrayed by her. And it reminded me a lot of in season 3 when they come to see her right before she's about to have the commitment hearing. And Maggie gives her the pills and says, you know, like, you really need to take these. You know, Saul said that you've been doing all these things. And she feels like they've kind of turned on her or betrayed her. And it the expression that she had in last night's episode reminded me a lot of that. I think it's like this feeling of betrayal. And I don't know what I'm not sure if I know exactly yet what she's, you know, feels betrayed about. I don't know if simplistic.
She wants
like,
Maggie to
let me have
her.
My fun. Like, just let me kind of just like be, like, let me live my life a little bit.
Well, Maggie doesn't, her sister does not trust her. With good reason.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, she really shouldn't. You know, there was a scene too earlier where Maggie and Franny kind of walk in on Max doing
self-help. How has Maggie never met Max?
Well, Maggie was off in Rome. You know, they were in Islamabad, right? And then she was off. And then Carrie went to Berlin. Was in Rome.
I get that. But how has she never met Max? That doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly what Sarah just said.
That's what, yeah,
no,
I just explained.
I know. It still doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. But
he's Carrie's only friend.
No, but there was a scene earlier, you know, where Maggie and Franny walk into Carrie's room and Max is doing software updates. And then Carrie kind of swoops in right at the last minute, like right as Maggie's about to catch her in, you know, this great big lie. And the very next scene after where Franny and Maggie are waiting on the steps as Carrie's saying goodbye to Max. And Carrie, once again, kind of just swoops in and kind of gets to act as the sort of wonderful mother, a little bit like the prodigal mother returns, kind of that thing of like, she's not doing, like, she gets all the glory without any of the work. And Maggie's face is so bitter. She's so angry at kind of what Carrie has done. I thought that was really interesting because, like, on the one hand, I do think that Maggie really, really deeply wants Carrie to just be a good mother and to be there for Franny and to be committed to that kind of life, because I think that's what Maggie understands. Like, that's what she gets. Like, she gets that. I don't think she gets Carrie's other deal. Like, she doesn't understand that, really. She understands motherhood and she understands that kind of responsibility and taking care of your children and stuff like that. And I thought that expression, you know, that she gave when Carrie, you know, said, how's your day, and Franny's just like elated to like be there with her mom, and Maggie just kind of like crosses her arms and looks over at them and she's like, I can't believe this bullshit. She's like,
well, it was partially bullshit because like Franny was so excited to see Carrie and right. Carrie had just like fucked up so badly, but also because
she was clearly not on the Seroquel too.
That too. But it just, the whole
Carrie is doing a really bad job at not acting suspicious. Like, why is Max Carrie there? Like, why is she borrowing his keys? Like, she's so bad at this.
It's been, like, between 4 and 6 years of Franny. And Maggie spent the first year of Franny's life being her mom, basically, and she really wanted Carrie to...
Carrie did do the last 3 years, though.
She did, and I believe that Carrie really wants to be a good mom and really wants to give Franny a good life, but I don't think she's capable of it.
I feel kind of exactly the same way as you. I think that she really, really wants badly to do it, but I'm not sure that she can. And I think that when Carrie has that realization, I don't think she's had that realization. I think she's still under the impression that if she could just do X or Y and Z, then she could do it. I don't know if she's had that realization that she can't do it, or she doesn't, like, maybe deep down in her core want to. So you have to want it enough for it to be the highest priority of all of the other priorities in your life. And right now for Carrie, it's like fourth on the list, like when it should.
I mean, that's another thing that I relate to.
Like, Carrie hasn't had that realization yet where she's like, Franny has to be the number one priority for the rest of my life. Like, she's not in that headspace yet. And I was thinking about this during the scene when I think about it a lot, and it used to be something that brought me a lot of joy. And for some reason, the switch just, like, flipped for me yesterday. The scene where Carrie gets Franny on the steps and she's like, how is your day? She picks her up and she makes this kind of, like, playful grunting noise or whatever as she picks her up and then she takes her inside. I was like, that is Claire Danes. Like, that, like, I was just totally taken out of the scene and I was like, that's Claire Danes. That's not Carrie Matheson. And I think the reason that I really glommed on to the Carrie-Franny relationship was because it was Claire Danes. And I was like, oh, this is so great. But that's not Carrie. I think that's Claire. I think that Claire is, like, probably an incredible mother, or at least she kind of, like, knows how to play an incredible-ish mother on TV. Like, I feel like she plays all those beats, you know, whenever she puts Franny to bed or when she's sending her off to school, or, like, those little tiny moments where you're just like, oh, like, God, she's really good with her. Like, she's really good with this kid. And I think that's Claire Danes and that's not Carrie Matheson. And there's very
well, I don't agree with that.
The fact that she's working with a 5-year-old kid.
Like, there's very few instances where I'm just like, that's not Carrie, that's Claire. The Franny scenes are those scenes. Like, I would disagree
with that, because she was very cool with her nieces in the early seasons. And she was,
but
like,
she was
cool
not a mom
Carrie.
Yet.
Well, I'm just saying, like, what Sarah is talking about is, I think Carrie has always been that cool aunt, and I think that's sort of what she is right now to Franny. Yeah. Like, she's the one who kind of gets the glory and gets to play around with her. I think that Carrie's always been that way, even in the early episodes. And I'm sure Claire as an actress is relating in that moment, like, that's her child, right, and this is how I feel about my child, and she's probably pulling on that experience. But I would disagree. I actually think Carrie's kind of been that person before with her nieces. I think that that's more of what they're portraying here, is that Maggie is, like, maybe, the responsible adult, right, and right. Carrie is not.
Maybe my point, though, is that whatever Carrie's doing with Franny and whatever she did with her nieces, you know, back in season one, it's superficial. That's kind of like some, you know, if you were the cool aunt, your role is a little bit superficial. You're there to be cool and you're there to, like, play around with them and have fun, but not have to do any of the hard stuff.
That's exactly the point.
And
that's what they're showing.
So more of my personal history that fits in here.
Jesus, therapy session.
I know. Is this Dr. Phil?
Well, no. I mean, there are so many reasons why this season is really, really resonating with me. And I was the only daughter of a single mom. And my mother was 1,000% devoted to me. And she died when I was really young. And all of a sudden, my cool uncles became my guardians. And they weren't cool anymore.
Because now they had to do the parenting
work.
They
had, like, responsibility.
Yeah, they had to parent you. Yeah, exactly.
And it fucking sucked. Because not only did I not have my mom, I didn't have my cool uncles anymore. And that is so relevant. Everything.
Well, Maggie doesn't have that problem.
I love this season so much because
Maggie's never going to be the cool aunt to Franny. Maggie's never going to be the
cool aunt. Everything about this season is making me think, okay, this is my childhood. This is my life now. Oh, this is my life as it will be in 10 years. Like, it's fucking with me, but in a really good way.
So, very cool. To go back to my point, though, about superficiality, like, Carrie's role as a mother right now seems superficial to me. She was the cool aunt in season one. I think my point, though, is that the way that I see Carrie acting is I see it as Claire, and I think that's the veneer of, like, it not feeling real. Like I said, there's very few moments in the entire sort of span of this show where I'm really taken out and I'm just like, that's Claire Danes, and, like, that's not Carrie Matheson, whom I feel is, like, this real person on the screen that I'm watching. There's very few instances where I feel that way. The instances where I'm, like, watching the character in Franny, it feels like there's, I guess it just feels less, I don't know, it feels like I'm watching an actor play this part. And I don't know if that's any fault of the writing or of the acting. I think it's just me sort of realizing, like, that's not who Carrie is. But Carrie, like, wants to be like that, and the writers maybe want to do that, and Claire just can't help it. Like, it's so weird. But I just kind of realized, I was like, that's why I think I became so attached to it, is because to some extent, maybe I, like, realized subconsciously that, like, oh, this is actually Claire, and it's not really
Claire drowning her baby.
No, not like that. Not like that. No, I mean, like, the happy moments, like the moments where Carrie's shown to be, like, you know, a loving mother, you know, like those moments where she's, like, being really silly or she's making funny faces or, you know, what, like those moments where I'm just like, would Carrie ever do that?
No. Yes. Yes, completely. And she did. Like, I really don't agree. I'm not saying that it's not. I'm saying that that's, I think that she's playing it like that very specifically. I think that
you think it's written, like, that way. Play acting.
Well, I think especially during season five, yeah, because she was trying to have a normal life and she was trying to be a normal mom with her normal boyfriend.
No, I disagree with that. Season five is where I felt like she was actually kind of in the zone with the whole motherhood thing. But I want to hear the rest of Gail's point.
Okay.
I was just going to say that I think that, and we've talked about this on the podcast a couple of times now, but I think that it's not that she... I think she is a good mother in a lot of ways, and I think she has her moments. I just don't think the season is about that. I think it's showing the cracks in her ability to be a mother when she flips the switch to become this, you know, CIA intelligence officer in whatever form that takes. I don't think she has the ability right now to have more than one obsession. And when she was dedicated to Franny, she was completely dedicated to Franny, and the show went out of their way to make that point,
yeah,
that, you know, she was doing that. So I guess I see it differently. I really do think that she was a good mother for a long stretch of time there. I just think that with this domino effect of what happened to Quinn, her meds not working, this grief, this drive that she has, she can't help herself, and she's back on the hunt in an Abu Nazir type way.
Yeah.
And I just think that obsession is, you know, taking over, because I think one of the other things that is interesting is, you know, she has, like, no qualms about all this illegal activity.
She said as much during her convo with Dante.
Yes. And we've seen her in the last two seasons. And actually, Ashley, you mentioned it earlier, even last season with Max saying, you really shouldn't go in there. You'll be on your own. Like, you know, I just feel like she's no longer risk averse. And I think that that's a side effect of her current state. So
this is definitely the first season. This is definitely the first season where she has maybe attempted to, or been forced to, balance this. Okay. Mm-hmm. I've got to be a mom. And also, okay, I've got to save the world thing. Like, before, she was able to kind of compartmentalize them and separate them.
Yes.
Either physically or, you know, in some other way, she, like, was.
And Maggie's a huge crutch, and she's right there.
Maggie
at her fingertips.
Is a huge crutch, but it kind of just, okay, eventually this leads to the question of, she's gonna realize that she can't do it. And we don't really have to get into the feminist aspects of, like, what the fuck are all of these like male writers doing, being like, Carrie can't do that. Like, we talked about that a few weeks ago. We've talked about it many times. It's a much larger discussion, and I kind of want to keep this podcast not, you know, 3 hours long. But, you know, it does kind of lead eventually. Carrie has, she's going to have some sort of reckoning where she's going to have to confront the fact that she has not been able to do them both. And she has some innate need within herself, and an innate desire to save the world. And she feels like it's her duty, you know, and it was her sort of, like, this is the reason that she was put on this planet, was to do this work. And she's the person who's best equipped to do that, which is a really sharp departure from how she was maybe at the end of season 5, where she said, I don't know how to do this any more than the rest of you guys. Now I think she's kind of come back around and said, I am the one who is equipped to do this.
Well, two points.
So she has that. And then the second half is she loves her child. She loves her child more than she ever thought that she could love anybody else in the world. And I think that Carrie understands. I feel like that reckoning is going to come along with some sort of understanding that those two loves and those two needs and desires might be diametrically opposed. And she's going to have to make a decision. She's going to have to make a choice about which one is more important to her. And I would be shocked if she chose Franny.
So I find that's a couple of the like things that you going. Said really interesting. First of all, the fact that you were like, I have been put on this earth for this reason.
Right.
Which is such an echo to what
she said to Brody.
Right, exactly.
Brody is Franny's father. Like, I feel like it's all tied together. Like,
it is all tied together. And I worry about what's coming next for all of them. And the fact that Maggie was Franny's de facto mom for the beginning of her life.
Actually, it's not ending well. I'm just telling you now, it's not going to end well.
Well, no, we all know it's not going to end well, and we're going to be posting this really, really after badly. We post. Yeah. Well, we're going to be posting the podcast after we post the Amy interview.
Mm-hmm.
So we all know that episode 7-10 now is going to be life-ruining.
Yeah, I feel like I had an inkling of that before. I know it's been confirmed. And what? Mm-hmm. When does that air? Does anyone know?
Oh, shit. I'll look.
I'm going on vacation at the end of April, and I might be on vacation when that episode airs, which was not planned.
While Ashley's looking that up, too, I think it's important to note that the show is about a
April 15th.
Intelligence officer who has bipolar disorder. This is not a show about a woman balancing life and work and an intelligence officer. Like, it's not, you know,
it's not like the
homemaking.
Of
it's homeland.
Not like the
yeah,
Perry, right. It's not. That's not.
It's
that
not.
Show.
It's just not. And we can fic it up and make it that way.
Absolutely.
But the reality is that They have a Franny problem. They've had it since they introduced her. Every season, they find a way to get rid of her. They're going to need to do that to free her up to do all this, plus season 8. So, unfortunately, you know, this is not headed in a good direction. I think, you know, maybe some of that can be remedied by the end of the series. But, you know, I think one of the things, though, I think they are being honest about is I don't think these intelligence officers that they're interviewing are problem-free when it comes to their home lives. Like, when mm-hmm. they go on their, you know, spy camp, I think it's fair to say that I'm sure these agents have divorces. They are single parents. They, you know, have issues with being tasked with going overseas and, you know, all this stuff. So I don't know, you know, I'm sure they're getting that feedback at spy camp too, besides just, like, here's what's going on in the world. So I do think it's fair that Carrie, as an intelligence officer, putting her life on the line and the country first, has, you know, set of issues personally, compounding the fact that she's bipolar and, you know, all this other stuff that she has going on. It's a drama. It's made for TV. I think that's all fair. So I think that, you know, for this season and this purpose, I think that the conflicts between her and Maggie are profound because we've seen the setup over seven seasons or over the six seasons prior leading up to this of where, you know, the different places Carrie's been and Maggie's role in her life and Maggie having been through that with Frank. And I think the interview that we were able to do with Maggie Amy Hargraves about Maggie. Good Lord.
She might as well be Maggie.
She really kind of expounds on that.
Yeah.
And Maggie's always been the adult to some degree in her relationship with Carrie. She was the primary caretaker of kind of like their dad and Carrie when the mom left. And so, you know, I think the show is doing a lot of justice by like looking at that relationship and truthfully, I think it's somewhat fair that Maggie's patience has run out when it's Absolutely. Not just Carrie's life she's screwing with. So, I mean, I like this story. I feel like last week it scared me because that's when I was talking about, I was ready for it to be bad, but I didn't realize how bad it would be. But at the same time, I think they're being very honest in it. And I think that's why it's kind of being set this way is Carrie is going to pay a price. There is a price for Carrie to have this side of her and to unlock it. And, you know, it's coming. The price is going to be steep.
Yeah, I mean, I want to kind of wrap up this discussion. But I think kind of in summary, you know, through four episodes, I'm as into the story that they're telling right now about Carrie as I have been in many, many, many years. I think that it's really interesting. And, you know, through the first four episodes, I'm more into kind of what they're doing now than I was in season six, five, four, three, probably since season two. Like, I feel like what they're doing with Carrie is really interesting. It feels really different. And I think Carrie is always my favorite part about every episode, but something feels like it feels a little bit different this year. It feels like I feel like kind of the stakes are higher actually for her, despite, you know, having lost even more people. Like, feels like the stakes are higher, feels like everything feels a little bit sharper. I'm really interested to see kind of the, you know, new crew that she's interacting with next week. Last question that I want to ask you guys though about Carrie, and then we have to move on to the Saul and O'Keefe stuff since we've already been talking for over an hour, is Dante has a few scenes this episode, and maybe just one or two. The big thing though, I think, that caught all of our eyes and ears is that after last week revealing to Carrie and confiding in her that he had an ex-girlfriend who was bipolar, who went through the entire sort of rigmarole with her medications and being able to get them right, he accompanies Carrie to this like street drug dealer or whatever to get all of her meds, you know, from India, and he's like, you're gonna have to watch out for her. And he was like, what, me? You won't be able to do it by yourself? And she's like, no, that's just the thing, like, I won't realize when I need to take my meds for this or that. And he seemed like surprised despite having revealed that he had a ex-girlfriend who was bipolar, and that to me set off a lot of I was like, what the fuck, like, this guy could not be more suspect. Where well, do you I think mean, he is right literally... now, like, in terms of elected officials of Mole City, where do we think he is?
I don't know what the I mean, maybe he's the city manager, I don't know, but you never, like, that really upset me, honestly. And it upset me that Carrie didn't catch on, because
girlfriend did not notice a fucking thing.
She did not. But, like, when I am not on my meds, you notice. Like, you, Sarah, notice.
Right.
That there's something up. And I don't see you every day or even very often. I talk to you a lot, but a lot of the time it's just on GChat or WhatsApp or whatever, but you notice, like, you mm-hmm. know something is fucking wrong with me. The fact that he could make that statement to Carrie after claiming to have been with a bipolar woman for years was...
It makes no sense.
It makes zero sense.
And so Also,
I owe you a mea culpa.
Right.
And I told you I was going to do this on the podcast, but when they first mentioned that Carrie was turning to street drugs, Sarah was like, oh, I didn't realize that they were talking about, like, Josie's medicine cabinet.
And you were like, Sarah, you
obviously,
idiot.
Obviously, dude, you're so stupid. And now this week, she literally
goes to street drugs.
Out of a
literally drugs off of the street.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so there you go ahead.
So my sort of spectrum of, like, fear for this story, I think my biggest fear is that these are just all massive plot holes that we're just like, okay, well, all these plot holes must mean that something else is going on. Something is super fishy.
Oh, you mean like conspiracy?
Here. Like conspiracy. Yes, exactly like conspiracy. So my biggest fear is that they will all amount to nothing. And then it's be like, nope, Dante's just a cool guy who's just kind of, I don't know, like doesn't catch on to.
And he bangs like, Carrie like a gong, but he's still a cool dude.
No. Okay, so my biggest fear is that there are just going to be all these plot holes and we're just going to think for a really long time that he's, like, the mole and, like, a bad dude and a suspect dude. And then they're going to want us to like him. And
but
we're going to be like,
no.
This
is why it's my favorite, like, season in years. It's because I have no fucking idea what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I am.
It's like 24, and I know that people. Sorry, I need a drink. I know, like, it's like 24, and I know that people were not really happy about that prior to the season. Our friend of the pod, Jordan, was not happy about that prior to the season.
Happy about what?
The fact that, like, this season looked like it was going down a similar
road
to 24.
Oh, okay, yeah, that it looked like 24-esque. Okay, yep.
And I have not watched a show in a very, very, very long time that had me so tangled up and topsy-turvy and confused and not knowing what was going to happen next. And that is one of the hallmarks of 24.
You just have to hope that there's a payoff. You just have to hope that there's a payoff. Because if it's not, and it's just like,
I'm wearing a 24 t-shirt right now.
You just have to hope that there's a payoff, because if there's not, then it's... Then it looks really bad.
Otto really wasn't. Otto didn't really pay off, and he was kind of a red herring. I mean, truthfully,
he was.
Right?
That's like, true. He was a red herring.
So I think in terms of Dante, I know we talked a little bit about it during the day today, and there was a couple of asks about it. But for me, I'm doubling down. like tag this for receipts. I'm even more convinced that he's mayor of Mole City, especially after his reaction to Carrie kind of saying, hey, you're going to have to watch me as I, like, surf these meds, and you're going to have to keep me straight and tell me what's up. I think it's giving him a lot of power.
That's
and
true.
A lot of trust.
It does
in
give
a
him
way
a lot.
That I just,
she trusts him very implicitly, which I kind of get. Like, it seems like they have some sort of kinship from their time in Afghanistan. So I get that. It doesn't just seem like he's some, like, random, like, Joe Schmo off the street or whatever. Like, they clearly, you know, have some sort of shared background. But it just seems like, I guess what I would say is that he doesn't seem like the fact, and I know that we're, like, harping on this bipolar ex-girlfriend thing a lot, but it's such a specific detail to put in for it not to mean anything. And it's like, okay, it could totally mean that he's the mole and like, you know, he just made that up to try to win her trust. Could also be like a thing. Like, he could turn out not to be the mole and he could turn out to be a good guy, which I would be okay with. It wouldn't, that doesn't bother me. Like, I don't, like, want Carrie to be surrounded by, like, people who are taking advantage of her. That's crazy. I just kind of have a feeling and a suspicion here, but I wouldn't mind if he turned out to be a good guy. But I also think, you know, if it turns out to be true that he had a bipolar ex-girlfriend, then, like, they're definitely, like, not hooking up. Like, this is, like I said, this is, like, Platonicville. Like, no sex shall pass. Like, there's, like, nothing else going on here. I still don't really get a lot of indications. But, of course, if he does turn out to be the mole, they're definitely fucking in, like, the next 4 weeks.
Absolutely.
Well, shout out to the anonymous asker with that question, too, because God forbid this, like, he is a good guy and is not the mayor of Mole City, I will forever call him Mall Cop of Mole City. because I think that
there's always going to be something a little bit off about him.
He's off.
He
he's
has totally them off. All.
Okay. All right. All right. So we haven't talked yet about the Saul and Brett O'Keefe stuff. It kind of reached the climax finally this episode. We finally got the release that we wanted.
Everything sounds sexual.
Everything sounds so sexual. Well, yeah.
I want to eat her waffles. I said all those things
on purpose. But so, you know, the third episode of this kind of mini arc of Saul on the compound with O'Keefe, it all kind of comes to a head this week, and a bunch of fucking people die. A dog dies.
That was the one thing. I don't spoil anybody on anything ever.
You did tell me that the dog died.
I told Sarah, I'm like, a dog dies. And but it's I think okay that
like
me.
Right either right after or right before the dog dies was the crawl scene, and I was like too happy about the crawl scene to like it didn't impact me as much that the dog died.
Well, you know, if a dog dies, it ruins my entire life. Okay. I would like to state for the record that I found the performances of Mandy Patinkin and of Jake Weber to be incredible this week. Mm-hmm. I said last week that I found I was really discovering Jake Weber as an actor, and this week really, really compounded that, but I found this to be, I would say, Mandy's strongest performance since The Choice.
Hmm. He was definitely, I think, Saul is much more in his element, I think, and Mandy, you know, by extension. I feel like Saul's better when he's angry. Like, the thing that Saul's I really can't stand about Saul is his kind of...
And by himself.
So the thing I can't really stand about Saul is his kind of, like, self-righteousness. Like, that just really gets under my skin. And I don't think, like, Mandy... I don't know. I think that he's an incredible actor, an incredible performer. But I can't get past the whole Saul-ness of it all when he's just being self-righteous and self-important about that sort of thing. I much more prefer when he just kind of like realizes like shit is hitting the fan and he's just gonna kind of like
well yell at people
and like be an old man. Like, I think that's a lot more
I don't know what it says about Mandy as an actor or about his performance as Saul, but he seems to be at his best, at least as far as I'm concerned, when he's acting alone. So, in The Choice, he, like, his conversation with Mira at the very end when she's like, I'm gonna come home, and he goes, yes. And everything about Saul and everything he needed and everything he wanted was just in his face, and he should have won a million Emmys for that scene alone. Yeah,
for that episode, he should have.
And in this episode, I felt really the same way. Like, he is at his absolute best when he is not reacting to somebody actually talking to him, but to somebody who's, like, on the phone with him. Because, of course, that stuff gets, like...
That's very specific.
Yeah, well, no, I don't I like, mean, kind that's... of understand what you're talking about right now, Ashley. Well, no. I feel like those performances are really different. I feel like his performance in The Choice and his performance in this episode were really different. And my favorite scenes from The Choice,
but the point is that they're both on the phone. Somebody else. So when he's talking to Mira in The Choice and when he's talking to O'Keefe in this episode, like, it's not alive back in...
He's just talking to an anonymous person on the other end of the phone.
Well, I mean, it's not a live back and forth. Well, like, yeah, it is like, when two I know people that, in the same
they don't
scene.
Actually, like, film them on a phone call at the same
so
time.
So I think when Mandy is able to sort of do, like, the other part in his head.
Okay.
I think he's better.
Oh, weird. Okay, I have to disagree. I actually think he's, like, super good with, like... I actually found him super compelling, like, that, especially that last scene where O'Keefe is being brought out by the FBI, and he's holding that flag, and it's very symbolic because he used it to, like, cover his face. And he's like, he's hiding himself behind the flag of this false patriotism bullshit he's spewing. It's so profound. Oh,
but also a little bit. The eye contact. Like, that was a little bit of a like, ugh. Like,
I think that was a little bit heavy-handed.
It felt a little bit so like his O'Keefe so like storyline. Senior in high school would write, or you know, like a senior.
Well, it
in
was so
write.
Very much. I disagree a with that too, though. The end of R is for Romeo.
Yeah,
which
it reminded
aired
me way
immediately
more.
After we saw all of those pictures of like Claire with the flag and Rupert with his like.
To me,
I don't know.
To me, the end was much more reminiscent of the end of New Carsmo, which I talked about on Twitter, and I think I talked about in the blog too. And the first thing that comes to mind is both were the fourth episodes of the season. And you know, Gail, you were talking about this last season. The way that they often structure seasons is in thirds, so they'll go 1-4, 5-8, and then 9-12, and so the fourth episode is usually the end of their first act, you know, of the season, right. And it's usually the end, like this, it's usually the end of a major storyline and the propulsion of the next one, and New Carsmell was definitely like that. Absolutely no fucking person that I've ever spoken to who's ever watched the show anticipated that that was what was going to happen at the end of the fourth episode of season two, that Carrie and Brody would meet in that way, in that such like such a polarizing way, and then she would follow him up to his hotel room, and instead of, you know, having sex there, which they kind of played with in that scene itself where she said, what are we going to do now? Like, you're going to kill me? Are you going to blame it on rough sex? And, you know, he says, well, I don't remember what he said.
It's worked for me before.
Yeah, it's worked for me before. And that, you know, they have this sort of argument / lover's quarrel there. And then she like fucking arrests him. And then he's carted out with like a black bag over his head. No one fucking, like, that was a stand up out of your fucking seat moment for every person who was watching the show. And the show was so big at that point that it was like, that was like appointment television at that point. No one fucking understood it, but it was also this great moment. It felt like the perfect execution of kind of those first four episodes and what they were, which start with Carrie getting the tape in Beirut, and then she watches the tape, and then she gets Brody. Like, that was the sequence of those episodes. It felt like this, it felt like you didn't know what was gonna, like, you had no idea what was going to happen next, and it was amazing TV.
I feel the same way about this episode.
You do feel the same way?
Similarly, yeah. Because
I don't feel like this episode even approaches the level of New Carsmell, which I've not soured
it
on,
doesn't
but
approach
it's not
the
as
level
as...
it just reminds me of it.
I know, that's why I was talking about it though. Like, that's why I brought it up, is because I think that they're similar in that respect of, I think that the way that the Saul O'Keefe storyline concluded in this episode was actually very neatly done and very well executed, and it was good TV. Like, it was suspenseful. It held my interest. I thought it was well-paced throughout. I thought that the editing was really good. The directing was really good. I thought the acting was exceptional, too. And it also, it had an ending that wasn't necessarily satisfying, but it felt a little bit bittersweet, actually, is how I'd... And that's how I would describe Carrie's reaction when Brody was arrested, is that she felt vindicated in some way, but she also felt like, shouldn't I feel better about this? And I feel like that's a little bit how Saul was feeling. You know, he caught O'Keefe, but not at all in the way that he wanted. All these people died. Like,
yeah, I don't think he felt that at all. I think the reason why it was over your face kind of symbolism is because O'Keefe has been the loudest person in the room, to quote Saul from last week. Like, he's been waving that patriotism at his convenience in everyone's face for almost a season and a half. And he's been using that as a, he's been weaponizing it. So in that scene where he's like literally hiding behind the flag as he's like being let out of the house, I thought was actually pretty, you know, powerful, because you don't see that American flag as part of the rebels. Like, that's not the flag that's hanging in front of their house. The only one with the American flag at that house is O'Keefe. And he's basically using that to weaponize the conversation and to poison it. And I felt like when Saul looks at O'Keefe in that last scene, I think he's distraught, truthfully. I think he's extremely, like, I think there is no way that he was okay with, I don't think he really cared to go get O'Keefe at all. I think he was forced into it because he had made that devil's bargain to get out of jail. Right. I think he had resigned himself to that. And then once he was there and O'Keefe blew that negotiation, Saul basically wanted out from there on. Like, he knew this going downhill.
I agree.
And he was all warnings.
My point wasn't that Saul was happy about what happened. The purpose and the mission was to catch O'Keefe, was to get him into custody. That's what Keane wanted from the very beginning. O'Keefe made it as difficult as possible for that to happen, you know, without maximizing the loss of life. Saul tried to prevent that from happening. But at the end of the day, they got him into custody. The bitter aspect of that is that Saul wasn't able to prevent that loss of life. Like, I think he said in the preview for the next episode, like, 3 children died. Like, fuck. Like, what a major fuck up. And
well, and it kind of brings into, you know, the
like, I would
fake
never classify
aspect
it as a victory or as a win, which is how all of the politicians on the show and in real life always want to talk about everything. They always want to talk about, is this a win for the Republicans or a win for the Democrats? And Wellington talks about that in at the beginning of the episode too. I think he's like, we really needed, like, one for the win column. Like, they're just classifying things in terms of wins and losses, and they're not putting it into the perspective of, like, there's actual human life at risk here. Like, people fucking died. And O'Keefe doesn't get that. You know, Wellington doesn't get that. I don't think Keane really gets that. I think Saul actually does get that, because Saul witnessed that firsthand. I think that I do agree with you. He was distraught. I think that the conversation at the end when he's talking to Keane and he says, sorry, it's too late. It's done. It's over. Like, I tried to stop it. I couldn't, you know, like, this is happening. It fucking sucks. Like, that was kind of the tone of that conversation. I think that he was kind of just like, God, I can't believe that this is how it ended. And it was over.
Well,
and I see a similar, it's like a resignation in his face as I saw in Carrie's face. When Carrie's watching Brody get carted out of that room, the way I always saw that scene in that episode too entirely is that Carrie had spent 6 months dreaming of, like, whenever I see Brody again, like, what am I going to say to him? And she thought about it over and over and over. And they have, like, the first interaction in front of the CIA where she, like, plays the part perfectly and she says exactly what she says and she really gets him to bite on that. And then they go into the bar and she tries it again, but then she slips and then he makes her, and then she loses her cool up in the hotel room and kind of reveals her true face. She says, I loved you. Like if only the circumstances had been, like, wildly different. And
right,
then,
but she had like a personal vendetta. Like, she was petty as he's being let out. Like,
she was
smug
petty,
as shit.
But she,
like, Saul is not petty or
Brody
smug in
that
moment.
She loved Brody.
And, yeah, but
I
Saul
think
doesn't have any of those same connections.
I think that there was a sense of resignation of, like, that was, like, this is that was it. Like, it should have felt like there was a climax, but it was at the same time anticlimactic. Like, we spent 3 episodes building up to this big sort of, like, shootout, and it's over in literally 20 seconds. It's like, God, like, dude, we didn't even have to do all this. But what
well,
we
that
know
I
is
agree
that O'Keefe
with
wouldn't have had it any other way. We talked about this last week. He's not a martyr. He's a coward. He used
yes
everyone else on that
compound as his own sort of human shields and bargaining chips. And he, even at the last second, went to his computer and was like broadcasting, you know, as he was being shot at. And, you know, that's not heroic because he never had altruistic purposes. His entire motive is to just rile everyone up.
Well, and that's the interesting part of the show is that he tells Saul that he's not in control either. And I don't think he was, truthfully. I think it had gotten away from him. But
he was not ultimately,
he had the control because when push came to shove and Saul says, tell them JJ's fine, he stayed silent. And so that little fake news, you know, that is so prevalent in our culture right now is actually what
you've got. I actually kind of liked how they did that. That was really
interesting. I do too. It was very smart. You've got easy access to guns, mm-hmm. rising tension.
Yeah, you're in absolutely.
Standoff. He's poisoned the conversation. These people are like, he's basically let the dogs loose, literally. And he's not giving them the safe word. Like, all right, guys, like JJ's fine. This is fake. He's still riding that selfish, narcissistic wave, and the guy picks up one of the million guns that are at this house, right. And goes and shoots the guy in the head.
Yeah, that was.
And I think it's actually awful. Really interesting how Homeland took some larger themes of what's going on in our country right now and brought them to scale in this episode within that 5-minute scene or whatever that was. I thought it was actually really powerful and well done. And for Homeland, typically it's usually about what happens somewhere else far away. And the last two episodes, it has really brought home for me this, you know, metaphorical battlefield on a suburban, you know, lawn in America and kind of what's going on here, the civil war that we are in. And I thought it was really well done. And I know the symbolism is a bit much, but I think it was powerful. He, you know, watching him and Saul make eye contact, like, I think you're right. I think Saul is kind of like, it didn't have to be this way. And my God, look what this came to. I think he's sad. I think he can't, you know, I think it's unfathomable to know that 19 people died, I think is what the episode sneak peek said. Needlessly, it's.
But O'Keefe's expression Homeland did at the well. Very end, he seemed a little bit defiant. Like he didn't seem like know. He Maybe. Was shared that same expression of sadness and, you know, distraughtness.
Well,
he seemed like he was just like, "I won, you lost." Because I think O'Keefe never. O'Keefe might not have ever thought that he was going to get out of there. Free, you know, he wasn't going to escape. He could either get out of there alive or he could get out of there dead. And I feel like his goal and his purpose was to escalate the situation as much as he possibly could so that something bad happened so that he could spin it, you know. That's why he wanted mm-hmm. the trial, like,
in, I think that's in front right of the but I think audience. If you watch
like he
that video
he wanted a battle Stanza. Yeah. He wanted a battle and he wanted a civil war. And I guess I just don't believe that his intentions were so great. Like, he didn't care that the women and children were going to be harmed. He said that the last episode. He said, if it really comes to that, then you know, that's what it will come to. I think he seemed a little bit – his expression there was not one of, like, I'm so upset that this happened. He seemed defiant towards Saul.
I don't know. I think that you could read it that way. I probably am spoiled a little bit because I watched that video Inside the Siege that aired after the episode was played live. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's Alex Gonza. I did see that,
but what did...
And Leslie Lenka-Glatter. Well, right away, Alex Gonza says that these two men making eye contact, they both realized they both failed. And that's the price not how was
I saw.
Steep.
I think that's how I saw Saul's reaction.
Well, to be fair, O'Keefe did nothing to earn a different one. So, I mean, I'm probably being too gracious.
But O'Keefe knew that terrible. Saul's goal. O'Keefe knew that Saul's goal was to minimize the loss of life and make sure that no one died. He knew that that was the goal because Saul said that from the very beginning, and he wanted to negotiate with him, and he wanted to play Peacemaker. Like mm-hmm. O'Keefe knew that. O'Keefe had no interest in that occurring because it didn't get him anything. What does O'Keefe get if he's arrested and no one else dies? Not as much as if he's arrested and he can then go and spin that the FBI has executed all of these people and they don't care about free America and they think that you guys are all a bunch of rednecks. They don't care about you. He gets a lot more out of the latter situation. I think he's just that disgusting of a person that it doesn't matter that all these people died.
Yeah. I think O'Keefe lost control of the situation and doesn't know what to do right now.
Well, I don't really know if it totally matters because it seems a little bit like that story's wrapped up and they're now moving on to O'Keefe didn't plant the fake news about JJ. It was Russia McNeckbeardy in the hospital who was the one taking all the pics.
Thank you to whoever sent that ask earlier. I am going to see JJ next week.
Oh, right.
Well, let's talk about him real quick. He, not Justin. Colton. Or JJ. So real quick, I want to give a shout out. I know a bunch of us were talking about how the hot rebel guy was, how hot he was. That's
Mr. Ponytail. Yes.
Yeah, Ponytail Man is Justin Kulkselaine. The character's name was Andy, which seems a little too benign for that guy.
Is that the guy with the who looks like a
he looks like he belongs in the Long family, like he's Howie Long's long lost kid.
His hair was like kind of reddish. Actually, he was the one who was ponytail? Checking the
yes
EMT
who shot the drone down.
Yeah, that was him. He was hot. I thought he was hot.
Yeah.
Well, Colton Ryan, who played the 16-year-old whose dog got murdered.
Oh shit.
Next week in a play in Boston.
Cool. Let's talk really quickly about Russia. This seems like they're going here, you know, obviously they've introduced that character now who's played by Costa Ronan, who was in the Americans and played, I think, like a Soviet spy or something like that. I haven't seen the Americans, but I think he plays another sort of Russian spy on that show. So we're obviously inferring, you know, in this season he will, you know, play some branch or arm of, you know, Russian intelligence or something like that. Mm-hmm. Seems like he was, you know, went into the hospital with the intent to spread fake news and now it's going to become information warfare. And I'm not as mad about that as I thought I would be.
I'm really mad about that because I work in a hospital.
Oh, well, that part is ridiculous. Like, there's no way that he would just...
There's no fucking way that would happen.
Of course, there's no way.
I work in a really, like, well-known, prestigious hospital where we have security
badges and stuff that you got to scan in and out. Yes, absolutely.
But absolutely not. There's no fucking way that he would be able to go behind the scenes like that and just put on, like...
I also don't know what kind of, like,
suit and like,
I don't know what kind of like Photoshop software he has on his phone where he was able to like take out all those people.
No. I rewatched it and he got a picture where there was only one person in it and then he just zoomed in so that he could crop her out.
That's what I thought happened. But then when I was looking at it on like the news report, it looked like it was zoomed back out again with all the people removed. But maybe you're right. It doesn't really matter. But I guess I'm not as I felt like I was kind of like, ugh, like, God, are we really going here? Like, can we just do something else that's not, like, exactly what's happening in the United States right now? Like, it's bad enough that Russia's actually interfering in our shit and our politicians don't seem to care. Like, do we have to watch this on TV? But I'm not as, like, down on it. Care. I'm not as down as on it as I thought it would be, and it might be because Russian McNeckbeardy is hot as well, minus the neck beard, but he's good looking. Like, I don't mind watching him sneak into a hospital in the most unrealistic way possible. But
well, I'm super into the nickname. I'm super into Russian McNeckbeardy as a name, and I want to use it. So I'm into the storyline. And then also, like, I know I talked about this in another podcast, but one of my favorite saw specific scenes is with Ivan, or Ivan or whatever. If maybe he could tie him back in to go get some intel, you know, like I'm super into this. I'm super into it.
I thought that Ivan, he was off at like Jack Bauer. I thought he was in like Jackson Hole skiing or something. Yes,
let's go visit and get some deets.
All Ivan right. killed Jack Bauer.
Oh my god.
I'm just telling you, like, he is just a badass.
Let's just all appreciate Ashley and the ridiculousness, because I really do. Like, you crack me up.
My ridiculousness? I'm offended.
Ashley, you are the most ridiculous person I know. I say that with love, but it's the truth.
I was going to say, because so I much am love. Supposed to come see you this weekend.
You are. Would you like a free place to stay?
Hey, before we get off the podcast, for everyone listening, if you haven't gone to the Hell Yeah Homeland site yet to read that Amy Hargraves interview, make sure you do that, because it's awesome. She is so gracious in her responses, and honestly, she's so detailed. She really answered the very specific questions that the group put together, and kudos to Sarah.
We had some good questions.
Yeah. Yeah, so please make sure you do that. It's so interesting. There is talk of Quinn on there, and her relationship to Quinn. Yeah,
I'll post a link in the post for this so that people can go and read it.
The only questions that I, Ashley, really had any interest in were about her dog, Fred.
And she answered them.
Yeah, she answered them in a very Ashley-esque way, actually. With lots of exclamation points.
Love like I said, you should have sent her all of the questions that I had about Fred. Maybe I will. Oh, actually.
Yeah, no. Don't attach it to the blog if you do. Do not. No. Because I know one of them was about, do his feet smell like Doritos?
Do his feet smell like Doritos? No, not Doritos. Fritos.
Frito feet.
Frito feet.
What is that? What's the difference?
Sometimes doggies have feet that smell Fritos. Maggie's feet smell like Fritos.
That's gross.
Maggie is a dog that you know. Fritos. Let's clarify.
Maggie the dog, not Maggie the character.
Maggie is a dog that Ashley knows. You're taking on a climb, and it's long enough to put the best of us on our backs. Walking up a slide. And then for those who don't, I was 5 miles off the track.